It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
This monument to liberalism right here behind me. They're going to have a lot of fun explaining that to their constituents, I can tell you that. This law is a disaster. Anybody who thinks we've moved beyond it is dead wrong. Obamacare should be repealed root and branch.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That was the majority leader in the Senate, the U.S. Senate, Mitch McConnell, and that was 2013 at CPAC. And it wasn't the only time he said that. He said it over and over and over and over again. And he told us, as did other Republican leaders, that if they couldn't do anything about it because they just had the House, if they only had the Senate. So Americans gave them the Senate. So now Republicans own the Senate. And then they said they couldn't do anything about Obamacare because they didn't have the presidency. And then we gave them the presidency. By the way, while Barack Obama was president, they voted. They had a really good repeal bill for Obamacare. But, of course, they knew that President Obama would not sign it. So they rousingly passed this bill and sent it to him to veto. And then they could boast to the home constituents that they tried to repeal Obamacare. The president wouldn't sign off on it. So then we collectively as Americans gave them the presidency with Donald Trump, and he promised that he would repeal Obamacare. And, of course, now we know that that was a lie. It was a lie on the part of Senator Mitch McConnell, because now that he has the opportunity, he is unwilling. He's unwilling to do it. I read an article just last week that really had some of the best explanation for what's going on here of any that I have read. And it caused me to look for the author, because the more I looked at what he had done, the more interested I was. So I asked him to join us today to talk about this and give us some background. Certainly he knows what he's talking about. His name is Angelo Codavilla. He's a professor emeritus of international relations at what is now the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. He served as a U.S. naval officer, a foreign service officer, and professional staff member of the Select Committee on Intelligence of the United States Senate. His books and articles range from French and Italian politics to the thoughts of Machiavelli and Montesquieu, to arms control and war and technology, ballistic missile defense. His articles have appeared in some of the most prestigious outlets in the country, from Commentary to National Review to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. Well, I guess it's arguable if New York Times is prestigious anymore, but it was, I'm sure, when his articles appeared. He graduated from Rutgers. There's so much to say about Angelo, but he immigrated to this country when he was 12 years old from Italy. There's a lot to say about him, but I wanted you to have the background before we welcome him to the show. Angelo, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
All right, so you served in the Senate, and you were a professional member of the Select Committee on Intelligence, the United States Senate. So you know a lot about the workings of the Senate. And based on that, you wrote an article just the first part of this week, called "The Real Reason the Republican Senate Isn't Repealing Obamacare." So, Angelo, what is the real reason?
The real reason is they don't want to. They don't want to because they are beholden to the insurance companies. And their own ideas, insofar as they have any, regarding health care, are, in fact, to the same as that which the Democrats said they had in 2009, and that is to make the insurance companies into public utilities, highly regulated public utilities. Now, the insurance companies clamor for this because they want a, and so do, by the way, the hospital administrators, they want an assured flow of money. Each one of those regulations was written to assure a certain constituency with a certain amount of money. And the bargaining that has been going on has been over who gets what money. Now, earlier on in the introduction, you said that the Republicans had a chance, so many chances to repeal and lied. They had even more than you mentioned. Look, anybody who's ever worked in Congress knows that the easiest thing that Congress can do, that any majority in any House can do if it wants to, is to stop spending money. Because in order to spend money, you have to have, so says the Constitution, a majority of the House, a majority of the Senate, and the president's signature. The moment that the Republicans got control of the House, they could simply not have funded Obamacare, period. They didn't have to do anything. All they had to do is not do something. Now, that is when Congress worked the way that it's supposed to work, with individual appropriations bills being passed for individual line items in the budget. But ever since the late Bush years, Congress has been operating on these yearly continuing resolutions. And then the question comes, if you are not willing to sign on to everything that comes down from the White House, then you are shutting down the government. The Republicans used the excuse of fearing shutting down the government to do essentially what they wanted to do, which is to keep Obamacare and essentially nearly all that Obama was proposing as well. They didn't do it because they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do it then. They don't want to do it now.
Yeah, absolutely. No argument from me, and that applies to so many other areas. But since we are wrestling with Obamacare right now, you bring out in this article specifically, you talk about Senate rules. You know, no one understands Senate rules better than Mitch McConnell. I think that's probably why he's majority leader, because he's a master of the rules. And so you say this whole business about the filibuster or the 60 votes allegedly needed, you say that's ridiculous. It could be done. Okay, so why?
That is pure nonsense. First of all, the 60-vote rule has been changed many, many times. There is nothing in the world sacred about it, and it can be changed by majority vote anytime. But that's not really the main point. The point is, despite that rule, it isn't what keeps things from being voted on. Because what keeps things from being voted on is an agreement made, which is not a rule, but simply an agreement that has become part of the Senate tradition, that after a measure to proceed fails to get 60 votes, then the Senate simply goes on to other business. Now, in the old days, if someone wanted to filibuster, they simply had to talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, and they had to hold the floor and until they turned blue, quite literally. And that involves talking all night, weeks on end, with relays, and to prevent the majority, in order to prevent this from going on, would have to be present for quorum calls, so that new legislative days could not be declared, and the same process could not be repeated day after day. So real filibusters ended up as theater, very bad theater for the filibusterers, because they would be reduced to speaking gibberish, whereas the majority could simply be demanding that votes be taken, yea or nay, on the questions of the day. Well, there hasn't been a real filibuster for well over half a century. Why? Precisely because a filibuster is highly inconvenient for the filibusterers. Mitch McConnell could very, very easily force anyone who wishes to filibuster to do so, which would be highly inconvenient, highly embarrassing for them, but he doesn't do it. He doesn't do it because he doesn't want to do it. It would be the easiest thing in the world to say, okay, you want to talk? Talk.
Yeah, and you say, you also point out something. This should be obvious, but it wasn't obvious to me. You said by using this alleged filibuster, which now means 60 votes, they don't actually have to vote on things. It's an avoidance of votes.
Oh,
and
no,
said that's why.
Just it. That's the whole point.
Yeah, they don't
neither
have to.
The majority nor the minority has to vote. Now, the first thing you got to know about the Senate, in fact, about the House, but mostly about the Senate, is that their primary preoccupation, number one, above all others, is not to vote on controversial matters.
Yeah.
They will do almost anything in the world not to cast a meaningful vote.
I can see that. I mean, you know, I think even, honestly, Angelo, I believe that regular people, regular voters, citizens are busy having lives, expecting that the people they elected should actually be doing the people's business, are beginning to see that this is a game that's been played now for, decades.
Really,
it's been a long time.
For this century, for the 21st century, look, let me take one step back, which is, this is very important, and very few people are aware of this. For most of this century, the Congress has not worked the way that it worked for the previous 200 years. That is to say, you no longer have bills brought to committee for committee hearings, votes in subcommittees, markup in committees, floor debates with real amendments. In each of those instances, individual senators had to vote on amendments, vote, go on the record about what they wanted and did not want. That they hated. They hated it above all other things. And that is why Republicans and Democrats have agreed to function the way they have been functioning. You have bills that are written in secret, behind closed doors, by leadership groups of either one party or the other, or both, and then sprung on the Senate. People vote on things they haven't read, and they vote on basically fidelity to party leaders. This is not the way that the U.S. government is supposed to work, and the results that we're getting are not American results. We are being governed in literally un-American ways, literally.
Mm. My guest is Angelo Codavilla. And by the way, Angelo taught political science at Claremont Graduate School for a long time. Don't you wish you were in his class? I wish I had been in his class. And before that, he served as the part of the professional staff, meaning there's a lot of staff. You could be a filer. You can be the computer person. You can be all kinds of things. But he was one of the professionals in the staff of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And that was during the years of 1977 and 85. And so,
right.
Angela, I want to ask you about that. Music's going to play in just a second. But, in fact, there it is right now. Because during that period of time, there was an upheaval in our intelligence services about which you know a lot about. It wasn't in the Senate. It was really in the House. And it took the form of a committee that was named after the committee chairman, Frank Church.
The church. Yeah, no, it was in the Senate. It was a church committee.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about that. Yes, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about that, okay? All right.
Okay.
By the way, this article that Angela wrote on the real reason the Republican Senate isn't repealing Obamacare will be on our Facebook page because it's really excellent. It's something for you to read. It says a lot more than we even talked about, and it says it beautifully. It's a good thing to share and read and pass on. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
The Church Committee was the first. It's also still today the most comprehensive investigation of intelligence in the United States or in the world. The first goal was to have an investigation because that was open and rigorous. Because before that, in the Senate and the House of the United States, and certainly in allies like Great Britain, the view was don't ask, don't tell. They'd rather not know. The senators, the congressmen would rather not know what was going on, and they were quite explicit in that, in what they said to J. Edgar Hoover or the directors of the Central Intelligence Agency. Please don't tell us. We'll give you a pile of money anyway. So the first goal was to actually have an investigation. Now, then it was important that we get started and succeed. This is a long answer, but how was it that the investigation happened when it did for the first time in 1975-76? I think the events of Watergate and the furor about the Vietnam War and the leaks like the Pentagon Papers had led to a pent-up interest in what the secret government had been doing. So instead of don't ask, don't tell, it was please let us know.
That's the voice of Frederick Schwartz. And what he's talking about is the formation of what came to be known as the Church Committee in the Senate, chaired by Frank Church. And my recollection, and then I'll let Angelo Cordovilla, who is my guest today, straighten me out here. But my understanding is that this was right on the heels of Watergate, the Nixon resignation. And it was, to my knowledge, the first time that the House was actually occupied by a significant number of influential leftists. That's my term for it. Anti-war, so haters of Nixon, and they proceeded to tackle the intelligence agencies and, from my perspective, to dismantle and weaken them. Angelo Cordovilla is my guest, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at the Pardee School of Global Studies. He served on the committee in the Senate that came after, was kind of the inheritor of what the Church Committee had done. Angelo, I would much prefer your description of what the Church Committee was. Expand on that, if you could.
Well, the Church Committee was the beginning of there are two answers to this. From a strictly institutional standpoint, the Church Committee and the intelligence committees that followed it simply subjected the intelligence agencies to all of the oversight that the rest of the government is subjected to. Through these committees, the people's representatives look at the details of what the agencies are doing from the standpoint of efficiency, effectiveness, et cetera, et cetera. So from that standpoint, they are an exceptionally good thing. How did it come about and what did they do? That's another story entirely. And it happened because it happened as a result, not of an outside attack on the agencies by leftists, but rather as a result of an alliance between leftists within the intelligence agencies and leftists in Congress and in the country in general. Just to give you to put a capstone on what I've just said. After Reagan's election, when I was on one of Reagan's transition team members for the CIA, I was walking out of CIA one day, and in was walking Bill Miller, who had been the, up until that moment, the staff director of the committee and had been the staff director of the Church Committee. And I said, Bill, what are you doing? And he said, I'm here to receive the Intelligence Medal. The agency, the CIA, was giving Bill Miller, the head of the Church Committee, its highest decoration ever. Why? Because the people who had taken power in the CIA and, for that matter, the FBI, as a result of these committees, had done so with the help, with the connivance, in partnership with the leadership of the Church Committee. Okay, so what did these internal leftists want to do? Well, first of all, they wanted to banish their bureaucratic enemies. This had to do with left-right divisions to some extent, but also an awful lot to do with bureaucratic, pure bureaucratic fights. The major one of concern to me was the fight over the role of counterintelligence. Now, counterintelligence in the intelligence business is another way of saying quality control, looking over one's own shoulder to see that one's own operations are not being unduly known and or controlled by the other side. Anyway, CIA has been allergic to counterintelligence since its founding and had been trying since 1975 to get rid of its only minimal paladin of counterintelligence, that was James Angleton. They did so. William Colby, the new director, got rid of Angleton, accusing him of all sorts of things. Which things, by the way, were not crimes or anything like that. They were simply, he was saying, the accusation was that he was dysfunctional to CIA. Well, in this, they were supported by the Church Committee. The Church Committee, as I say, empowered a new generation of intelligence people. And these were, as I said, generally on the left. The general narrative, especially on the right, concerning the Church Committee, misses all of that fact.
Is it Herbert Romanstein? Herbert.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I interviewed.
Well.
Yes,
I knew him well.
Yes. Yes, I spent some time talking with him about their Church Committee probably 15 years ago. This is a tremendous interest to me. And this is certainly, I learned a lot from him, but one of the things I remember, and I want to confirm this with you, was the Church Committee that actually set up that wall of separation between the intelligence agencies so that they could not communicate, and that was really what laid the predicate for 9/11 when there was no communication.
I think that's overstating it.
Okay.
The wall of separation existed and still exists for two reasons. The main one, believe it or not, has nothing to do with principles. It has to do with the fact that these agencies are terribly jealous about their own sources and their own operations, and they don't like to have their what they are doing gainsaid, contradicted by anybody else. So bureaucracy is the primary reason for the wall of separation. The second one, of course, is that there really is and should be a difference between the way that intelligence agencies handle information concerning American citizens and non-citizens. Non-citizens have no right to privacy, whereas American citizens most certainly do. Moreover, the FBI has the power to arrest people and to charge them with all sorts of things. CIA does not and should not have. These are different. They have different different objectives. They're not the same thing. Now, the fact that terrorist subversives of various kinds work that seam is true. And it does require a certain amount of of bridging, but it doesn't, that bridge, that division cannot be absolutely obliterated.
Mm. All right.
And no one really is suggesting doing that.
You said the church committee did bring in a new generation of intelligence personnel.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if you think that was good or bad.
Bad.
Okay.
Now, hold on for a moment. I don't mean by saying this to second the narrative of many conservatives that the intelligence agencies were doing great before then and did bad afterwards. Not so. The CIA, especially, had a puffed up reputation before then and has a puffed up reputation now. They don't know nearly as much as they claim to know. They, back then and now, they conflate their opinions with facts. What was wrong with intelligence agencies then and what is wrong with them now is not that they are too terribly efficient, it is that they are too terribly inefficient and don't nearly live up to their reputations.
Well, you know, and on the heels of that, do you recall a time when things switched? Okay, I'm making some assumptions here. To where the intelligence agencies and their gathering became the fodder for political weaponry. I don't remember that until the Nixon years. I don't remember maybe I just don't know. Were the intelligence agencies used as a political weapon primarily through Barack Obama's presidency?
Oh no! That goes way back. They've always been partisan. If you read any of the memoirs of the first generation of intelligence people, you see clear admittances that whatever else was going on, nothing would take precedence to briefing the New York Times and the Washington Post. I mean, and they would do this for and or against particular policies, et cetera, et cetera. But generally, until Nixon, until Nixon, the agencies generally supported presidents, generally, more or less. With Nixon, they, because of the left-right split, they became antagonistic to his presidency. They were certainly antagonistic to Ronald Reagan. I mean, they did everything they could to undermine him. Leaks of all sorts, so-called studies, so-called estimates that would come out and be leaked just at the wrong time from the administration standpoint. In the 1980s, the agencies were totally politicized against Ronald Reagan.
Mm. You remember, of course, remember in real time the service of J. Edgar Hoover, the long-serving FBI director whose reputation has been so trashed that you don't dare say good things about him. But I have a feeling you'll say what you think. So what was his leadership like, and certainly compared to some of the things that James Comey has done in his position there? How would you compare the two? Because I know J. Edgar Hoover used his power also.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I think that J. Edgar Hoover would never have been as brazen as James Comey was in his interference in American politics. J. Edgar Hoover interfered plenty, but he did it much more subtly by spreading the right kind of dirt to the right kind of people as he saw it. But he did not go out and essentially endorse a candidate as he did as Comey did with Hillary Clinton. But at least Hoover had a certain amount of self-restraint. I can't imagine him having then reversed himself simply to cover his own rear end. I mean, James Comey is a cheap and strident version of J. Edgar Hoover. They're doing the same kind of thing, but I would say Comey is Hoover without class.
Oh, interesting. Well, let me. This is going to be have to require a short answer, and it's going to be hard. I don't need to tell you that the deep state is leaking. You know what? I'm going to have to ask you this on the other side of the break, because there's the music. I would like to know what you would do to fix what's wrong with our intelligence agencies. My guest is Angelo Codavilla, and he was a professor emeritus of international relations at Purdue School of Global Studies at Boston University. He's a senior editor, by the way, at the American Spectator. He's a prolific author, writer, and he's had so many different lives, it's hard to know which one we're going to talk about, but we'll come up with some. We've got some great stuff to talk about, so please stay tuned. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Mr. President, dear friends, dear people of America, it is a great joy for me once again to be in your country, and I thank you for your warm welcome. My cordial greetings and good wishes go to all the people of this land. I thank you for opening your hearts to me and for supporting me by your prayers. I assure you of my own prayers. To everyone, I repeat on this occasion what I said on that memorable day in 1979 when I arrived in Boston. On my part, I come to you, America, with sentiments of friendship, reverence, and esteem. I come as one who already knows you and loves you, as one who wishes you to fulfill completely your noble destiny of service to the world. Today, like then, I come to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ to all those who freely choose to listen to me, to tell again the story of God's love in the world.
That was the voice of Pope John Paul II. He was the pope that served during the period of time when Ronald Reagan was president. That was him speaking in 1987 when he came to the United States to visit. And the reason I played that is because my guest, Angelo Codavilla, was born in Italy. And even if Pope John Paul wasn't the pope when you were there, Angelo, I'm sure that conjures up some memories, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
You came here when you were 12 years old, right?
Yeah, I was 13, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so what was life like in Italy when you were growing up there?
Well, we were, of course, very poor. It was right after the war. For me, other than the poverty, the main feature of life was the educational system, which was excellent. I came to America not knowing a word of English, but I sure knew my Latin, and I was way ahead of my age group in mathematics, way, way ahead, science, and all sorts of things. So it was, we were poor, but culturally quite wealthy.
Yeah, I should say that you went to Rutgers University. You also got your master's at the University of Notre Dame. You went to get your PhD at Claremont Graduate School. You were a research fellow at Carnegie European You were a Carnegie European Research Fellow. I could go on and on.
Yeah, no, I've done a whole bunch of things, yeah.
You have. That's true. You have done a whole bunch of things. But I want to talk about Europe just for a second, Angelo, because I think when I was thinking about your life and I was thinking about the timeline here, I did think, well, this was post-World War II. This was coming on the heels of Mussolini, when the country went through so much under his dictatorship. And then I think, well, then that reminds me of France also during that period of time. Then it reminds me of Germany. And then I had to ask myself, do you think that sometimes Americans' view, kind of romantic view of Italy, of Rome, of France and Paris and Germany is kind of off base?
Well, of course it is. Way off base. Sure. There was nothing romantic in the way that I grew up, of course. Well, I didn't flush a toilet until I got on the ship coming to America. Didn't turn on a hot water tap. Didn't take a shower until I came here. No. There's nothing romantic about poverty. It's a beautiful. Italy's a beautiful country. The cuisine is wonderful. None better. Of course, at the time we didn't have much food. We did have great wine, though, because the vineyards were not destroyed. But a lot of things have changed over there. Throughout Europe, the educational system is not what it was. Back then, it was strictly merit, very strictly a merit system. I mean, you had to take exams to get into the sixth grade, and that was... by definition, two-thirds would fail to get into the sixth grade. The rising through the educational system was extremely rigorous. All of that is gone in Europe right now. Europe today does not... Look, there was a great book written by Louis Gann and Peter Degnan, The Rebirth of Europe, about how the Europe of... De Gaulle, De Gasperi, Adenauer rose from the ashes of World War II. That Europe is gone. It's a vastly different Europe right now. One cannot minimize the effects of both the socialist system, the demographic collapse of Europe, and the immigration of, or I should say, the migration. Of Muslim peoples into Europe. It's a vastly different country, vastly different continent.
You've answered in part my question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If you were to sort of diagnose why Europe declined so quickly, I would say, I know coming on the heels of the war, it was devastating, at least for, well, three countries that I just mentioned, devastating for Germany, devastating for Italy,
also
devastating
for everybody,
France.
Everybody.
Yeah, so...
There were no winners in that war.
Right. All right, so devastated economically and then having to build from rubble, but also sometimes, you know, difficult times makes us better people. So why do you think that Europe has declined so much morally and spiritually?
That is the biggest of questions. Look, I would have to point to one thing above all, and that is the decline of Christianity in Europe. And I would have to point to the churches themselves. Pope John Paul II was the great exception to that. He did what he could to revive the faith of Europe, but by the time he came, it already had largely gone away. You take away the basis for the civilization, and the civilization goes away no matter what. The civilization of Europe does not consist of culinary recipes. The civilization consists of faith in what made you who you are, and the faith that made Europe what it was faith in Jesus Christ. Mm. I mean, that goes away, and then you get faith in retirement systems, in underfunded retirement systems. And you have so-called family policies that discourage families. You have a demographic collapse. Mm-hmm. And you have now populations that are way beyond reproducing, way beyond replace, way underneath replacement level, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
The content is dying.
Yeah, it's a demographic. It's a demographic winter, as some people would say, because Europe has embraced abortion to such an extent that they're, you know, that's why I guess many countries in Europe wanted to start immigrating so many people, was because they were not, they weren't producing the number of people they needed for workers. So there's an effect on.
Abortion is simply the feeling that it's not worth it to bring children into the world. That is too expensive, too many regulations. You have enormous youth unemployment. Even though you have very few young people, they're largely unemployed. The system does not allow them to get jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Does not allow them to... there is something called demosclerosis, regulations, interest groups in power that simply choke the society. We're seeing some of it here in America as well,
mm-hmm.
But America, of course, is much bigger and more diverse, and so we're not quite in the grip of that.
Mm-hmm.
But no, our civilization is in trouble.
I want to go back to something you touched on, because it reminded me. You said that the core that made Western civilization in Europe, of course, which was the center of it, was Christianity and faith in Christ. And I think that there's no question the values that came from that, the freeing up of men to develop their own strengths and be important in each and individual ways inside of God. And I could go on and on. But it's interesting to me. The thing to me that illustrates what you're talking about, that when we lose that core, we have nothing to fight with, was recently when the terrorist attack happened in London, and Theresa May made some vapid statement, which others have made similar statements, but she was talking about England, something about our values. The Islamists, it's our Western values, but never any mention, nothing to counter the Islamists'
what
passion and
what
drive for Allah.
Are
yeah.
What
yeah.
are they and why do you have them?
Exactly. So it was just such a weak response to an enemy who knows exactly what they believe and where they're going. And then I thought, you know, Trump's speech in Poland, whatever you think of Donald Trump, that speech in Poland was the opposite of that, didn't you think?
Oh, yeah, sure. Look, I mean, he started with John Paul II, as any sensate person would, speaking in Poland. Why not quote the most important Pole in the half a millennium, you know? We want God, said John Paul II.
Isn't it funny?
We want God.
And then the media mocked him for that, not even knowing, because they don't know much. They don't have much knowledge.
Not even knowing that the birth of freedom in Poland came when the Polish people yelled out, "We want God," and not the bureaucracy.
Yeah, and so they're so silly. It's just amazing, really, the ignorance. Okay, I want to ask you. This is a personal question. I'm going to go back to your bio here. I've already said that you taught. Political science. But you were also a U.S. Navy officer. You served in the Foreign Service. You, again, we said, were a professional staff member of the Select Committee on Intelligence of the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
You've written all kinds of books. You've written all kinds of commentary. Developed part of the Strategic Defense Initiative under Ronald Reagan's term. I could go on and on. So my question is this. Which of those hats that you wore was the most rewarding to you?
You know, the most rewarding thing. Two different things. The biggest contribution I've ever made, I think, was to put together a couple of pieces of technology that became the U.S. Space Laser Program. That that's the biggest effect I think I ever had on international affairs. But what was most rewarding to me, I taught ancient political theory at North Dakota State. And there's nothing like teaching natural law to farmers. They get it.
Isn't it funny?
I've never had a better teaching experience than a North. I taught at Princeton. I taught at Stanford. I taught a lot of places. I've never had such a wonderful teaching experience as I had at North Dakota State, teaching natural law to farmers.
Do you think, isn't it funny?
You can use barnyard examples all over the place.
Well, isn't it amazing how what's grown to be the elites of this country, and I'm sure it's true worldwide, but I'll pick on this country, tend to always think that people that are in the center of the country, what they call flyover country, somehow the IQ is not very high, when in fact, they often see things a lot more clearly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Yeah. It's been such a pleasure.
Anybody who's ever read Plato marvels, especially people, highbrow folks who have never read Plato, not most of them. When they read Plato, they say, this guy's talking about shoemakers and and farmers and the simplest thing in the world. How come?
Yeah, how come?
That is called the exegesis of common sense.
Angela, we're out of time. I want to go to your class. I want to be in North Dakota or someplace where you're teaching, but I can't. Angelo Codavilla, thank you so much, sir. We could put it your one article, and then they can track you down on the American Spectator if they want more. Thank you so much for your time and your service to this country. Sandy Rios in the morning.